welcome to the VOD Pod.
It's just religion.
Episode of the VOD Pod, the podcast dedicated to everything that you can stream on your subscription services. Because let's face it, who watches live TV these days? I'm Nathaniel Smith, a Vodzilla writer and Halloween skeptic, I would say. I think Halloween is probably the ugliest time of year. Feel free to have a go at me on Twitter for that one. And I am very excited about today's episode because, although I'm a Halloween skeptic, we are going to go for something of a Halloween special. We're talking Stranger Things, which has been categorized as a horror TV series, of course. And hopefully we might even have some spooky hidden gems along the way as well. But that's all down to my guest for today, who is Becky Brynolf.
Thanks for having me.
Becky works for Shelter, which is an incredible charity, but she also has worked in film in the past, does script readings, and is about to start a podcast, I believe, on storytelling. Is that right?
Yes, it's a podcast with my friend Amy Jones, who works at The Pool, and it's called And Then What? And essentially it's just born of a love of Amy making me laugh with stories and me making her laugh back. And we are actually looking for guests to come on and tell all kinds of stories that we couldn't possibly tell. So so I might be coming back your way in the future.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to. I'm a huge fan of storytelling as well, which I guess is how I ended up being a film critic. So do you know when that will be going live?
We are in the middle of just recording and editing the first two episodes, and we're hoping to be going live sort of early November-ish.
Okay, listen out for that one, guys. That should be great. Well, let us start off as normal with the hidden gem.
This one's not so obvious. The hidden gem.
In this part of the show, I ask my guests to recommend something on the streaming services. That wasn't even an intentional pun.
That's quite apt.
Yeah, I'm just very tired and said the wrong word. But yes, on streaming services that you can watch. And, well, it's Halloween weekend. Well, or it is when we're recording. Chances are you're listening to this post-Halloween. But still, in the spirit of things, what hidden gem do you have to recommend?
Well, I've actually got a couple, because seeing as Stranger Things is what we're talking about most of this week, and what I feel like they've really nailed is the production design and getting that feel and tone of the 80s absolutely perfect. So I thought I'd go for a couple of horror movies, as it's Halloween, and look for ones that also have a really fantastic eye for bang-on production design that makes you feel as if you're back in the decade. So starting off with... And this is, I was listening to an episode that you guys did recently where the guest was talking about how difficult it is to recommend a hidden gem to your audience because you'd imagine that they've heard them all already. But I'll just take a punt. So I tried two. So maybe they haven't heard of one, they might have heard of the other one. So We Are Still Here, starring the fantastic Scream Queen Barbara Crampton, who, for people who might not be aware, she was in The Reanimator and You're Next, and she has a really long history of being in sort of slightly trashy but fantastic daytime soaps in America. And it's just a really fantastic, classic, haunted house horror story set in, you know, snow-swept New England, and it's a really sleepy village, but obviously things aren't what they seem, and they get, like, a psychic in, and it just really evokes that fantastic feel of the 70s, and you just essentially feel like I don't know if you've ever seen Black Dynamite, Nathaniel.
Yes, I have actually seen Black Dynamite.
You have? Okay, brilliant. So you know how that film just, it feels as though it was made a few decades ago rather than it was made a few years ago. That's exactly the kind of feeling I get with We Are Still Here. And then another one, I don't know if you've heard of this one, House of the Devil.
Is that Ty West?
Yes.
I know the name. So I said I was a Halloween skeptic when I started. This goes hand in hand with having seen very few horror films. It's definitely a genre. So, and my understanding of Ty West is that he makes quite extreme horror films, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not hugely familiar with his entire body of work, but House of the Devil really, yeah, it makes quite an impact, if that's your introduction to his work, I think. It's another one that really just... it feels as though it could have been made a couple of decades ago rather than just a few years ago. And it's about a girl in college and she's trying to raise enough money for rent. And then she sees an advert for, you know, an almost too good to be true advert to babysit in the newspaper, and it's like, for $400, that is rent and then some. I mean, this is set in like the 80s, so rent was actually fairly cheap back then. But you know, of course, the things are not as they seem, and then terrifying things ensue. So you can watch those, and I highly recommend watching those because they're really fantastic Halloween viewing. If you go to your screaming service, so you can see, you can see We Are Still Here on Amazon Prime, and House of the Devil is on something slightly different that I've not heard of before, called Amazon Shudder, which I'm assuming is okay. exclusively
what that is, kind of horror themed one. There is a separate streaming service called Shudder, which specializes in horror films, and Vodzilla covers quite a lot of the horror films that they post on Shudder. So if you're a horror aficionado, Shudder is an excellent streaming service to sign up to, and then you can add Shudder to your Amazon Prime account as like an add-on. You can watch Shudder streaming films through Amazon Prime, but it is actually the best way to watch it would be on Shudder. So which one was on Shudder? House of the Devil?
House of the Devil's on Shudder, and We Are Still Here is on Amazon Prime.
Okay, so I want to hear some more about these films. We Are Still Here, I think this would definitely count as a hidden gem in that I've never even heard of it. I had heard of House of the Devil, but this one's totally new to me. So naturally, my first instinct is to go to Google, look it up. I see that it's an 18-rated film with, like, three rather ominous-looking skulls on the front cover. Are we talking, like, hardcore horror here?
It is, yeah. I saw it at Fright Fest a couple of years ago, and it's really bizarre because the director-writer, Ted... Oh, I can never pronounce his surname. I want to say...
Georgiou, maybe? Or
I can't remember, but he's like the nicest, most lovely, affable man who comes out and speaks in front of the audience, and you think, what is wrong with you internally that you're writing these really horrific horror stories? But maybe that's, you know, he gets it all out on the page, and so when he gets in front of people, he's actually very, very nice. But it's just absolutely fantastic. It really, I feel like Fright Fest audiences are quite hard to impress,
right?
You know, that they will have arrived having already consumed a lot of horror, and it's directors and writers like this who work with actresses like Barbara Crampton and fantastic productions whose name I can't remember, the production designer really deserves an award for this, but who go out of their way to really impress a horror audience who know exactly who's going to watch it, who's really going to get a kick out of it, and they try and find ways to make you feel like you've seen something completely brand new, even though it's completely evoking this bygone era of slow, kind of easily paced horror that really builds up to the action and really, you know, kind of draws you in, kind of exorcist-y type horror movie in that sense.
So are we talking sort of more intense atmosphere than jump scares?
Kind of a mix of the two. The jump scares come a bit later on, but it really takes its time to build the atmosphere and kind of lull you into this false sense of security while always underlaying this kind of sense of complete unease, because you know you're watching a horror, and it's threaded very, very well together, and then all just lets loose in the third act, which I absolutely love. It's really, really good.
And House of the Devil, again, probably does constitute hidden gem. I feel like horror is perhaps the genre of hidden gems. Are we talking gore here, or psychological thrills?
Oh, totally, kind of leaning more on the psychological side of things, and then moving towards kind of really unsettling stuff towards the end. I wouldn't call it gore. I really don't want to give too much away. It kind of feeds into, I remember you guys were talking about Mindhunter a couple of episodes ago, and it really kind of feeds into that sense of what the nation was talking about at the time, like what America was really concerned about is like kind of the occult and, you know, serial killers and you know, sleepy towns being rocked by terrible tragedies and things like that, and it really kind of sits in that era of American history and that kind of that period of horror. It's really, really good.
Would you say you're into sort of like 70s and 80s horror then, or?
I'm just really into good horror, I would say. Just, I mean, there's really great and really bad stuff in every kind of genre film, and I just really, really appreciate when you get filmmakers who know that their audience is coming to this film already fully loaded and with a ton of shared experience and shared knowledge already, and when they really try and give you something new or something just really impressive, like fantastic production design, I think is always really, really fantastic to see.
We're going to talk a lot more about nostalgia when we cover Stranger Things, but both horror films set in the past, do they lean on that quite heavily, or is it more the means to an end?
I would say, I mean, they're kind of stories that could happen at any time. They don't, you know, necessarily rely on like, oh, you know, they've got their mobile phone that could easily get them out of this situation sort of kind of plot, which tends to let down a lot of modern horror. See, like, characters make stupid decisions that could easily be solved by the fact that they have a mobile phone. No, I wouldn't say that it leans too heavily on the set time period, but it's something about setting these stories in those time periods that just helps kind of aid that escapism and that experience of going into another time, another world, when things were a lot more sinister, I feel.
Yeah, although, you know, sometimes I wonder what will be the sort of defining horror film of this early 21st century, where I guess, you know, the real world is already pretty scary, and we've got nuclear war that could happen at any moment. We've got the rise of the right. We've got global warming. We've got a whole host of things that in the real world that make us scared. And so I'm quite intrigued as to see what will be the horror film that speaks to our time.
That's quite interesting. I mean, you make a good point. There's a lot to be terrified of right now. I just wonder, I suppose that we have to, doesn't necessarily have to be something that's kind of technology focused, but maybe, yeah, something that kind of evokes that this feeling of global threat and people in charge who don't necessarily have our best interests at heart, who, you know, are actually quite dangerous in power. Maybe wondering things like The Purge. I mean, we're kind of, I would not be surprised if we ended up in that situation in a few years' time.
It has taken on a weird significance and has stuck around in the pop culture because of its themes, I guess. Yeah, that could be an interesting one. Well, listeners, if you can think of a horror film that really speaks about and to the 21st century, do tweet at the VOD Pod on Twitter. I'll be really intrigued to hear your answers, and I'll read them out in the next episode.
Oh, I've actually got another one. Sorry, oh, yeah. I just thought. Sorry, yeah. Purge and Get Out, I would say, is. Have you seen it, Get Out?
Yes, actually, I loved Get Out. That was. That'll probably be what we'll get the most suggestions for as well. No, Get Out's terrific. Blumhouse also made The Purge, so they seem to have this thing for like, I guess when your budget is as low as Blumhouse, you know, they give you $5 million before you, for you to make your first film. And with a budget that low, you can't really afford to do a period piece. So a lot of them are quite current, I guess.
Very true. And I suppose with a budget that low, you really just have to make sure that the story is completely robust, so that you don't have to rely on all the extra faff.
It's got a hook. In fact, they have, I think it's Blumhouse that have one out at the moment called Happy Death Day, which is Groundhog Day, apart from you die at the end of every day.
I'm really looking forward to seeing that one. That kind of concept just sounds right up my street.
Yeah, well, it's very much their trade in stock, isn't it, of like, here's one idea that we'll explore for the, it's almost Twilight Zone-y.
Yeah, actually, that's a very good way of putting Blumhouse. Yeah, I really like that way of describing them.
In return, I have a horror film to a horror film hidden gem to recommend to you. It's, I guess, a sort of like trapped in the attic type film. It's about a woman who is held captive by her evil stepmother. It's Cinderella, directed by Kenneth Branagh.
I was wondering if you were going to work this in.
I mean, talk about a horror film for our times. It'll scare you, it'll thrill you, and that's on Netflix. But Becky's suggestions were We Are Still Here, which is on Amazon Prime, and House of the Devil, which is on Shudder. And now we'll move on to the big release. And this week, our big release really, truly is one. It has been, hyped up to some degree after season one was, I think, quite an unexpected hit. It's one of Netflix's flagship original properties. It's Stranger Things, and season two is out now. Becky, before you tell me what you thought about this one, were you a fan of season one of Stranger Things?
I was a fan, definitely. Like you say, season one was a bit of a sleeper hit. I think it had been out for a little bit, and you'd hear people mention, oh, this new Netflix series with Winona Ryder, which, you know, for sometimes it's like, oh, okay, that's quite interesting. But it wasn't until I started watching it, and then I thought, oh my God, this is actually brilliant. And that's when I think the ripple effect started taking on, and it just took on a life of its own, and I think maybe just became something much bigger than the filmmakers kind of expected it to be, or maybe even Netflix expected it to be, I wonder. Which I guess we'll come on to when we talk about the second season. But I absolutely adored the first season. I thought it was really... that kind of nostalgia factor, production design, which you know I love, and just a good story and something that really harked back to that frenetic energy of those kind of Spielberg films, you know, like The Goonies, where everything was, you know, you watch it now as an adult, it's quite stressful because the kids never shut up. But when you're a kid, you're just like, I want to be in that gang and I want to have these adventures. And this is exactly how me and my friends behave. And I just really love seeing that brought back in the modern sense, but still keeping it very, very 80s.
I was a little more conflicted about season one of Stranger Things. I enjoyed it. I thought it was, you know, very, very watchable. And I finished the whole series, which is saying something for me because I'm always hopping between the start of a new series. And it takes something quite impressive to hook me to watch till the end of a series. And I did. I thought it was really enjoyable. Some good child performances, and the adult cast I thought were great. I particularly enjoyed David Harbour, but I don't think I quite bought into the adoration of it. I was suspicious of the nostalgia, which we'll talk about in a bit, and I felt like its plot was perhaps a little flimsy in places, but I was nevertheless looking forward to Stranger Things 2. They're calling it that to make it seem more like a film, and the Duffer Sure. Brothers will have you believe that it is just a long film. But it's released in TV format anyway, so if you wanted to make a film, make one. what do you think of season two so far?
Conflicted. it's sort of that classic entertainment thing of the first thing was really successful, so let's make something totally different but exactly the same. And I was just watching season two and just thinking, okay, so... I didn't realise they were going to continue down this storyline. When they ended the first season with the kids playing D&D and they were talking about like some kind of Hydra monster, I thought, oh, okay, that's going to be the thing next season. Cool. So they're going to kind of do like a monster per season that they all defeat. And it's just going to be one of those Sunnydale things where the town's just messed up and they just kind of deal with it season to season, almost like anthology kind of vibes.
Yeah,
but no, it's just sort of they've carried on this storyline where I was like, oh, okay, you're going to try and mine that for as much as possible, and everything is sort of different but exactly the same. So we've got once again a new girl arrives and kind of shakes up the party. Steve continues to have fantastic hair and good one-liners. Jim Hopper continues to be kind of grizzled and lovable. Justice for Barb kind of comes back in some way, shape or form.
And Winona Ryder's frantic as anything.
Oh, still frantic. And they've managed to somehow give her another like arts and crafts puzzle to solve.
Yeah.
Like I loved the Christmas lights in the first one, and they've sort of, without giving too much away for anyone who hasn't actually watched it yet, like they try to give her something similar. That doesn't quite work for me. I feel like there are a lot of questions about the logic of it. But I mean, one thing that has changed that I feel like has sort of been to the show's kind of benefit and detriment is how they've dealt with Eleven, because obviously she sort of disappeared at the end of the first season and we find out where she's been this whole time, and she goes on kind of her own journey, but she's largely kept kind of separate from the gang and from everyone else. And I feel like with a fantastic character like Eleven, you've kind of got to commit to one way or the other. Either give her something to do with everyone and see her interact with others, or, you know, just let's never have her back and, and let's like explore another really interesting kind of character of that ilk. It's like you say.
I feel much the same way. Just this kind of feeling of like, I'm watching it. I'm entertained enough, but also, you know, the fulcrum of it is still Will. Will's. He's still the one that's like, basically, you know, traveling into the Upside Down. That's not a spoiler. It happens in he has these like flashes to essentially the Upside Down, and so he's still being a poor and neglected child, and his mum is still being like, I don't know what's going on with my son. Yeah, it's fine, I think. I'm with you. I think one of the biggest errors has been carrying on the story from the first one.
Yeah.
Particularly running with the whole thing of the like government conspiracy, which I think was one of the weaker elements of the first series, because it felt very generic. And I also just don't believe that any government has the capacity to be that that well oiled and secretive. You know, most of the time they're struggling to do the non-secret things. So it just felt like quite a generic element of it, of these men in suits covering things up and driving around in black cars. Felt quite derivative, and they've lent into that a bit more this time. And there are bits that feel superfluous as well. I think so. There's a new girl in the group, Max, who I think is a lot of fun, and she brings a different angle to it. So I'm enjoying that. But we're also following her older brother's rivalry with Steve.
It's all a bit confusing. Like I was thinking, it's something I do a lot when I read script. Is like I have a look at it, when part of the feedback is, are there any characters that you could completely lift out and it wouldn't really affect the main drive of the show? And I feel like those two characters, Max and, well, less so Max, particularly the brother, I'm one episode away from the end of series two, and I still don't really get what, because they were kind of red herrings for a little bit. I thought, are they part of the conspiracy? Is there something weird going on? They haven't really revealed, you know, why they're there or why there's so much tension between them, but it's just not that. Yeah, they are a bit of a red herring. I feel like they're characters you could easily lift out of it and just be like, meh. But I do like Max, like you say. She's a character with a lot of spirit, and she does shake things up in the party. And I really enjoyed scenes with her. But, oh, the brother annoys me.
Like, yeah, and does feel superfluous. I feel like, oh my goodness, how have I forgotten his name? The main kid, Finn Wolfhard, the one that had the greatest connection with...
Oh,
11.
Mike,
yeah. I feel like Mike hasn't had that much to do this season as well.
No.
Apart from be a bit grumpy and not allow Max into the group. I guess I'm also a bit suspicious with the introduction of Max. They have started, I don't know whether they change this as it goes on, but the first instinct of 11 seeing Max is jealousy. And I just think a much more interesting route, rather than have the only two girls in the friendship group be immediately jealous of one another, for it to then tell a story of female friendship as well, because it's quite a boys' own club as it is. And then so when the first interaction you see between them is one of jealousy and suspicion, and that to me felt like a bit of a shame.
Yeah, I was really disappointed at that moment, because I mean, when they introduced Max, and I thought, oh, okay, we've got, you know, if Eleven's not hanging around much this season, then we've got another Smurfette for the gang. Okay, fair enough. But with the hopes that, yeah, Eleven would sort of rejoin and they'd all kind of be a kid gang together. But yeah, it's just sort of, it's a bit obvious, isn't it? Just to have the two girls, you know, for that to be the main kind of emotion between them. And you just think, oh, there's so much more you could explore, because they're, you know, they're really interesting, layered, complex characters. And the first knee-jerk reaction shouldn't be, well, the writer's first knee-jerk reaction shouldn't be, oh, and then they'll be really jealous because
yes.
of this.
Yes, and it feels kind of gendered in that sense, doesn't it? Because they're girls, and like they're meant to be the only girls in the group. It's a bit of a shame. So I want to bring up nostalgia, because it's something that regularly frustrates me at the moment, the way so many big projects lean on specifically 80s nostalgia. I'd be more interested if it was nostalgia for, say, the 60s or something, but that wouldn't happen because we have sort of middle-aged men making this, right? There was one woman director, but the rest are all men, and mostly these Duffer brothers. But we also see it in stuff like It and It Follows and all sorts of projects that are like, hey, remember the 80s? Here was a thing that existed in the 80s. Look at this bit of merchandise. And this music sounds like it's from the 80s, right? Now, I was born in 1990, and I sort of feel like I've been forced to have this secondhand love for the 80s and everything it stood for. And I feel like Stranger Things Season 2 kind of doubles down on that a bit. Mm-hmm. Is it a problem for you? Did you roll your eyes when they dressed up as Ghostbusters, or did you think, well, of course,
no,
they're kids in the 80s, they'll dress
that.
Up as Ghostbusters?
Yeah, well, precisely, because I've got a really great picture of a friend of mine who dressed as a Ghostbuster when he was like 3 or 4, and it's the most adorable picture of him asleep on the couch, like with his little with his outfit and the proton pack on his back, and I just think, oh, that's exactly what that kind of time was like.
So do you have a problem with the nostalgia then?
No, not necessarily. I mean, because it's not trying to, like, I don't feel like it's constantly lampshading, because I'm trying to think of a good way to put it. Obviously, every single reference is something that's going on in the 80s, but I don't feel like it's the stuff that's kind of risen to the surface over the years that that people just think is so iconically 80s. It's a lot of the stuff that's really, you have to do a little bit of research if it's not immediately familiar, and it really goes kind of deep into the decade. And that's what I really like about, have you seen The Americans?
No, I haven't.
Ah, okay, so that's another one. That's a really great kind of spy thriller TV series set in the 80s in America, like at a height of kind of Cold War threat, about two basically Russian spies who have been embedded in America for 18 years. They're married, they have children, and for everyone looking just assumes they're a normal everyday American couple, but they're actually KGB agents. And that show does it really, really well. Like all the music, all the design, even tiny little details like food products in the cupboards are things that are absolutely true to the era, but aren't things that are the things that the family fortunes answers, kind of the first thing that pops into your head, sort of things about the 80s. I mean, at least that's how kind of I felt about the first series of Stranger Things. The second series does ham up, the decade a bit more, particularly with the music, I feel. And it does kind of do a bit of a, hey, remember this thing that you really liked from series one? We did it again. Which is something that I really hate about Riverdale season two. I feel like that, and what made me worry about Stranger Things season two, was the internet, essentially, and how strongly people respond to series one. Mm. How much does that affect what happens in season two? Which has massively happened to Riverdale, and really, I mean, the quality wasn't amazing before. I love a bit of trash, but it's like really gone down with season two. And they've managed to just tread a line with Stranger Things, I feel.
But yes, we're sounding quite negative for Stranger Things, but
I know,
like you'll still have a good time if you like the first one. There'll be a lot of things to enjoy. I'm frustrated with it just because I don't mind nostalgia. One of my favorite films is Stand By Me, which is, I guess, nostalgic for the 50s, presumably. But for me, that's not so much about it being in the 50s. It's nostalgia for a time of life. More about childhood. And I sometimes feel like the 80s is a bit of a storytelling crutch for a lot of people, because it automatically targets a demographic of people who be like, oh, I remember that. Yeah, and it sometimes comes across as a bit of a substitute for, I don't know, something
good story.
Something a little deeper. Whereas I think nostalgia for more abstract things than a specific era, I personally find more effective. And I think Stranger Things is best when it is kind of about childhood rather than about childhood in the 80s. And so I do enjoy the scenes of, you know, them all interacting and being friends. And I think it's quite credible interactions between the four boys. You believe their friendship. And so, you know, I'm down on it, but it is, I totally get why people like it as well.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Like, we've been a bit negative about it, but the truth is, you're right. Like, the kids, there are a lot of fantastic performances in the show, and the kids in particular, you do strongly believe that they are friends off camera as well as on. And I really enjoy spending time with these characters. I want to be in that gang. And like you say, it's the moments when it's just kind of more focused on character and what it is to be that age. Where you really get that kind of, oh, I'm enjoying this show, rather than when you go back to kind of weird conspiracy theory stuff. And just a shout out to, I don't know whether this is a spoiler, but there's a brilliant guest actor for this season who was kind of very famous for that era, can I say?
It's in the credits of episode one,
right?
Oh,
there we go. Oh, yeah, Sean Astin. Who obviously everyone knows from The Goonies. And he just does a really great turn as this kind of affable, if slightly dull and uncool grown-up that I imagine the kids, like the characters from The Goonies, would have probably grown into anyway.
Yeah.
So I think he's fantastic in this. I think he's really, really good. Kind of sends himself up a little bit and just completely, very believable. Like, I think we've all met that guy during those times in our lives. And I think it's, really, really good.
He'll always be Sam Gamgee to me. So.
Yeah.
So that is Stranger Things Season 2, which is on Netflix right now. And let's be honest, if you're interested in it, you've probably already watched it all. Let us know what you think on Twitter. And now we move on to the double bill.
When one ain't enough for you, you know what you gotta do. Just take two with a double bill.
This part of the show, we look at something that's in cinemas at the moment, generally one of the bigger releases, and we suggest things that you might want to watch to accompany it or perhaps replace it, something that complements it in terms of theme or director or cinematographer maybe. And this week, well, there's one box office behemoth in the cinemas and everything else is probably trembling in its wake. Thor Ragnarok is out. So I'm intrigued as to what double bills we're going to suggest. But did you manage to see it, Becky?
I did. I managed to squeeze it in yesterday.
Me
right
too.
Before I went to a horror movie marathon.
give me a couple of sentences. What did you make of it?
So I love Taika Waititi, the director.
Yeah.
And it felt very much Taika Waititi does Marvel, which is wonderful, until the third act, which is what I feel like with a lot of Marvel movies at the moment. When you get kind of really interesting directors, it really feels like their movie for acts one and two, and then act three is just sort of, it could be any other Marvel movie fight scene, really. All the Taika bits that are definitely Taika, just he's perfect for this sort of character.
Yeah, I enjoyed it in much the same way I enjoy most Marvel films, which is at the time I have a fun time and then I forget about it pretty swiftly. I obviously enjoyed, you know, Korg. I thought he was a really funny character and elements like that. And, he's definitely tried to change up the aesthetic a bit and change up the tone. And he's gone some way to doing that. And I appreciate that. All the weird stuff with Jeff Goldblum and Rachel House, who is, you know, the probation officer from Hunt for the Wilder People. So, you know, it's very much, it is almost different. And I think the thing that frustrates me is that ultimately it's not different. He's changed little bits of the aesthetic. He's tweaked the tone a little bit. He's changed the character a little bit. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it's still very much a Marvel film. And that frustrated me because it's quite dull. but
I know what you mean. Like, when I'd heard, it always happens when, you know, you get one of those big screenings for a Marvel film, and then film Twitter all of a sudden is just gushing about this film and saying it's the best thing ever, it's the most amazing film we've ever seen. And so I always, having worked in film and been around that crowd, I just kind of take things with a pinch of salt now, because it's very easy to get really swept up in that and to really believe the hype. And then when I go watch it, it was like, that was a really fun film and I enjoyed it, but I'm not going to declare it like my top 10 of the year already.
I'll never buy into the conspiracy theories about critics are paid off by Disney's them. That's obviously ridiculous, but I do think they get a pretty soft ball, Marvel films, from the critics. I always appreciate the people that are a little more rigorous in their assessment. But what would you suggest as something to double bill? Say you've gone to see Thor Ragnarok and you've come back. What could you then watch?
Well, if listeners are listening to this podcast before Friday the 3rd of November and before 10:50 p.m., I would thoroughly recommend watching Boy on Film 4. So that is Taika Waititi's first film that up until pretty much this year has never really been seen outside of Australia or New Zealand legally. But then a distribution company in London, well, kind of a small kind of distribution thing, I don't know, they call Misc Films, they basically brought it to the Prince Charles, and it's utterly wonderful. It completely sums up Taika Waititi as a director 100%. But if you can't see that, then one thing you definitely can stream, and you've mentioned it already in the podcast, is Hunt for the World People, which is available on Netflix. And that's who's the kid, what's he called again,
Julian Dennison,
Sam Neill, Julian Dennison, and obviously Rachel House as well, who makes a really funny turn in Thor Ragnarok. So that's definitely one you can watch, because I think the great thing about what Taika Waititi does is he's very, I mean, throughout all of his films, he's very drawn to characters who, and this is why he's kind of perfect for Thor, is he's drawn to characters who have this sort of overinflated sense of self-worth, who are really overly confident in their abilities, but all of that hides kind of a much deeper insecurity that everyone can recognise in themselves, and that's where the level playing field is. But he mines a lot of humour from that overly confident kind of bravado to begin with, which he does brilliantly with Thor, and does wonderfully with the kid and Hunt for the World People, and with Boy, with the kid's dad, and it's just one, and also, you know, to a degree in What We Do in the Shadows.
Hunt for the World People is just a very compassionate film, isn't it? It's very warm towards its characters.
Yeah, that's the thing. I like when filmmakers like their characters.
Yeah.
When they don't make them make really stupid decisions just for the sake of hurrying things along, when, you know, they actually really care for them, and you get that a lot with basically everything Taika does.
There was a great Taika Waititi quote recently in an interview where someone said, would you ever make a drama? And he said, yeah, I'd like to make a drama, I guess. And then he said, wait, no, sorry, I've just got to correct myself on that. Now, why would I be sad and stuff? And it's basically just like, he just has this sunny outlook where, you know, he'll be hard-hitting when he needs to be, or, there's sadness woven into his films, but he wants to make you smile, and he does it with, like, real panache.
Well, he did. Did you see this thing he put on Twitter the other day? I think somebody had tweeted at him saying, like, you know, really enjoyed Thor, but enough with all the humour and you know, the funny side of things with Marvel. And he just replied saying, yeah, God, you know, screw the world, you know, more sadness, please, too much laughter, none of that.
Yeah.
And it was a very good point. I mean, I'm just paraphrasing terribly. He obviously was a lot funnier about it, but he's right, you know, as we were talking about quite near the start of the episode, the world is really scary and sad at the moment, and why not smile and laugh and look at the warmer things in life and just have put a warm glow on things as much as possible.
And Hunt for the World of People is on Netflix, isn't
Netflix.
It?
Netflix. Yeah. Still there, thank God.
My double bill recommendation is a little niche, so you're going to have to bear with me on this one.
Okay.
So if you go to BFI Player Plus, which is the BFI's subscription service, they have a whole bunch of classic and world films on there. And you could watch Ran by Akira Kurosawa. Have you seen it?
I have not.
So it is an interpretation of King Lear, set in feudal Japan. It's one of Kurosawa's last films, made in 1985. And Kurosawa, who's obviously famous for things like Seven Samurai and Ikiru, embraced colour in a big way. And a lot of people have picked up on the aesthetics of Thor Ragnarok and like, oh, it's so colourful. And Marvel definitely seems to be trying to go down this route with Guardians of the Galaxy and that kind of thing, having big neon colours, making it as colourful as possible and going for that aesthetic as opposed to like, let's make it darker. and people seem to be really responding to it. But I often find that the colour is quite fake. Whereas when you watch Kurosawa deal with colour, and you know, it is hundreds of extras in painstaking feudal era Japan costumes with sort of the flags of their group coming off their backs and just these massive chaotic battles where all of these people are fighting one another, and it's just this crazy world of colour, and all of the greens really of the grass, they pop and the fire burns really brightly, and it's just one of the most astonishing uses of colour I've ever seen in a film. And I think if you respond to the aesthetic of sort of Marvel as it's currently making its films, where it's very bright and poppy and that kind of thing, watch a master at work with Ran, which is admittedly 2 hours 40 minutes long and very Shakespearean and also very Japanese. But it just shows, it's just that, yeah, I know, but it's an incredible film, and it's just, it shows what you can do with colour at a far more tactile and practical level without a single drop of CGI in the whole film. I guess if you want a stronger connection than that, it's also a Shakespearean film about feuding families, competing for the throne of their kingdom, and that's certainly what the Thor films have aimed for. And I think the strongest aspects of the Thor films are when it's the interactions between Thor and Loki, and I think Hela as their sister brings in a nice extra element to that. And you know, Odin feels a bit like the warlord from Ran, wandering around looking a little lost. So it's one of my most tenuous connections yet, but I guess I was just thinking about the use of colour in film. And to be honest, any excuse I can get to recommend Ran to people, because it's one of Kurosawa's, well, one of my favourite, I was about to say it's one of his best, but there's so many Kurosawa films I haven't seen. It's definitely one of my favourites of his, though. And that's on BFI Player Plus, which is actually a great service. So those are our two recommendations. We've got Hunt for the Wilder People, although with the caveat, watch Boy on Film 4 if you can, and Ran, which is on BFI Player Plus. That's all for this episode of the VodPod. Thank you, Becky, so much for your insights, your thoughts on Stranger Things 2. I look forward to hearing your podcast.
Oh, thanks very much. Thank you very much for having me on. And I'm sure I'll be in touch soon to get you telling stories on our one.
And I'll gladly do that. Thank you, as ever, to Tongues for letting us use their song Religion. Thank you to Sam Grover for the jingles. And thank you to you guys, the listeners. Please do... I mean, I believe reviewing us on iTunes helps. Definitely tweeting about us and sharing about it on Facebook is great as well. and hey, there are legions of Stranger Things 2 fans out there that will want to listen to this and our opinions, so please do share it. We'll be back next time. We're hoping to cover The Punisher. Until then, have courage and be kind.